Hi, this is Alaska Reed, and you're listening to Songminer. Today's guest is Gus from Caro Caro Bonito. This is the second episode in a two-part series that I did because we just had a lot to say to each other. This episode goes more in depth about the demo Make Believe. We talk about going on tour. Gus talks a lot about Ohio, which I love because that's where my family is originally from, half of my family. Talks about traveling around the Midwest from the British perspective, which I find really funny. I think I stay silent on some of the commuting comments when he's like, and it's so far away from place X to place Z. And I'm silent because I'm just like, I fucking crush a 5 hour, 6 hour drive in the day if I have to. I don't like that about myself, but that's the truth. Anyway, that aside, we have a great discussion. Gus talks a lot about lyrics and also just how much thought he puts into this song in particular and songs in general and how it's kind of always going on in the back of his head. You know, he talks about writing on the plane. He talks about writing in the hotel room, recording something when his band member is asleep. He talks about writing lyrics in the park and plein air, just on and on. So it's super cool. It's really amazing to think about that. Think about how somebody next to you could be writing a song. Somebody on the plane. Or if you're me, you're like anxiously practicing your set in your head on the plane like a dummy. Please enjoy this episode. Thank you so much for listening to Songminer. I have some exciting new guests coming up. And yeah, here we go. Here's me and Gus Bonito talking about the demo Make Believe off of the album Time and Place by Caro Caro Bonito. There's that line that you have in Make Believe demo lyrics where you just says like, and I just repeat that nothing in my head can hurt me, however real it seems.
Yeah, it's so dark. Yes. Well, so the final lyric in the song is it's the second verse. Oh, it's the sort of weird like quasi middle eight thing, and it's sorry, I've got to go through the song in my head to recount this. It goes. And awake I free. Yeah. So So now the lyric ended up being "Now awake I freeze," right? And in and it was also, as a side note, it was really interesting collating all this material for this podcast. So I collated all the previous drafts of the lyrics I could find. I found about three earlier drafts of the lyrics and two demos, an early instrumental demo and an earlier kind of MIDI logic demo. And I also opened up the project file for the final Make Believe, which is really interesting in a production sense. So all of this stuff is really fresh in my mind, and it sort of reminded me of things that inevitably I had forgotten. And it's really interesting actually that you picked up on that lyric, because the reason it would have changed to "Then awake I freeze," it's a narrative thing. You know, I think actually advancing a narrative in a song and making it clear what you're singing about, not that it always has to be clear, but I think if you want to say something, it's worth making it clear. Or if you want something to be received, it's worth making sure that it is received, right? Mm. It's a narrative thing. And actually, I can see why I made the decision, because it does make what's happening clearer. It's so to explain. So all KKB songs really have a concept, a really specific topic idea. And actually that's often just expressed in the title of the song. And the songs often start with a title and the lyric is an exploration of that concept. You know, I think of previous songs like Cinema, KKB song Cinema. It's about going to the cinema. Wouldn't it be cool to have a song that was going to the cinema? Simple as that. Make Believe is slightly more complicated because it's really about a category of experiences, which actually, you know, arguably are not make believe at all. It's this arena of lucid dreaming and something that I've seen referred to as maladaptive daydreaming. I don't know if that's an extremely technical term, but I feel like it demonstrates what I'm you know, I was thinking of. These experiences which, you know, in a slightly kind of stereotypical way, make us question the boundary between what is perceived and what is real. And I mean, I think I've never lucid dreamt. I don't have that. Well, I haven't had that propensity up till now. So I don't know exactly what it feels like, but I found the accounts of people who had done that fascinating. And you know, there's a lyric in the song, about the sunlight beating on my skin. That's taken from a lucid dreamer's account of their experience and how they say, oh, the thing I always notice is, you know, I can feel the sunlight on my skin. And I was like, well, that's incredible. That's definitely going in the song. So it's about this kind of category of experiences. And it's funny because I think, again, another total songwriting cliche, you don't realize what you're trying to say in a song until much later, and then you read it back and you're like, well, obviously that's what that song's about. And
so it's such a thing. It's crazy.
It's ridiculous. I was reading back the lyrics for this song and I felt a bit embarrassed. I was like, oh right, it's about losing control of your life. Well, I already sort of knew that at the time, but I mean, it's a really it's a really sort of sincere personal expression of, you know, the loss of control or being scared of what you can't control in life, really. Which you
see,
know,
it so distilled later. You're like, oh my god, this is what I was doing.
It's almost like you've just written the sentence down with no, I mean, that's how I was reading the lyric back. Like, this isn't even like a metaphor, really. It's just that, you know. But it's funny. I mean, I guess maybe there's a reason. I think those, you know, the maladaptive daydreaming, lucid dreaming things resonated with the time and place sort of aesthetic in a way anyway. But no, I mean, you know what? At some point, I'm actually bringing up all these sort of pieces of anecdotes, but I'm realizing that actually, in a way, maybe a good thing for me to do would be to actually just run you through the story of how this song happened.
I would love that, yeah.
Because I, you know, collating all this stuff, I definitely got a sense of that again. And yeah, I think it does explain, you know, for example, the themes that have that just ended up coming out through the song. So the song Make Believe started in Oberlin, Ohio, and the demo is
Ohio.
It's so real. Yeah, no, of course.
That's where my dad's from, but it's good songwriting country. Yeah, my dad's not from Oberlin, but he's from Ohio, and it's just good. I mean, some of my favorite songwriters are from Ohio, so I like that this origin story is Oberlin, Ohio. Okay,
definitely.
Continue.
Oh no, it's definitely some true Americana in this KKB anecdote. So this was that tour that I mentioned earlier, this 2017 spring, mostly college-oriented, but not just college-oriented tour that KKB went on, and we did New York and then flew to Oberlin, Ohio, and we played at the little venue cafe they have at the college there. And then we flew on to the West Coast, right? And so that would have been the old three-piece KKB set. So this was just post-Benita Generation. So we were playing our electropop set at the time. And one instrument that we always use in that set, and I still have, is the Casio SA46 keyboard. On I think on KKB's Wikipedia page, it misquotes a previous interview that said that we mainly use a Casio SA45. That's not right. The Casio, I do have a Casio SA45, and confusingly, it's used on Make Believe, but the Casio SA46 is the keyboard that I, you know, used a lot on Intro Benito era KKB stuff, and have written a lot of music on, because it's just a great handy keyboard. It's a little keyboard, it takes batteries, the batteries last for ages in there, it's got a bunch of tones, you know, it's got mini keys, which is fine for me, internal speakers, obviously. Yeah, just an extremely, extremely useful instrument, basically. And So point being, this was in the live set at the time. We actually played one on stage. And often I would bring it, I would say, you know, to the sound person, oh, can I take this off stage actually before the show? Because I want to, maybe I want to replace the batteries, or I want to practice some of the riffs on it, or often just play around. And that's exactly what happened at Oberlin. So I remember we were put in some kind of backroom classroom. You know, I think it was a classroom. It had a blackboard in it. In fact, I'm pretty sure there's a picture or video of us from this classroom. You know, Jamie wrote a bunch of nonsense non-mathematics on the board, and we sort of jokingly kind of posed with it or something. There's some pretty real souvenir of this moment. But anyway, in amidst all that, I was just sitting on a chair in this repurposed classroom, you know, this green room classroom, playing around on the Casio SA46, as I often did. And, you know, I think to come up with some ideas, you do have to say to yourself, okay, come on, let's come up with some stuff. And I think knowing that Time and Place was in the offing, I don't think it would have been cool Time and Place yet. I don't even think we would have had much material at all for it at that point. You know, I said, okay, no, look, I'm on tour. I've got some time in this room. Let's play around and you know, try and make a thing happen. And I was very interested at that time in writing songs with the bass line first. And that was quite specific and quite new for me at that time. In fact, I'd say the Time and Place era is the one I most readily associate with me using that technique. And it's an interesting technique because you'll be playing a bass line and then your melody can go on top. And there, you know, the fact that you're not playing chords means that there's potentially some room for tonal ambiguity, which is cool. I often think of this thing that happens in Oasis songs where the second degree chord of the scale often becomes a major instead of minor. To me, that's a very, very indie rock gesture. Like, as soon as that gesture comes out, you know you're listening to, you know, an indie rock record, to me anyway. So it's those kinds of gestures that starting with the bass line opened up to me a bit. And so, yeah, I'm playing this bass line. I think I'm in the wrong key here, but it's a da-da. Just that, which on its own, I mean, is not a bad idea. I mean, obviously, I thought it was a great idea, but, you know, not an extremely remarkable seeming idea. It's not like some crazy chord sequence where, like, you know, it's not like I just sat down and came up with the bass line for Good Times by Chic or something. I mean, it's a pretty humble little idea, that, right? But, you know, I was just sort of turning it around in my hands, as you do with songwriting ideas, and because I think I was in the situation where I was just in the green room, didn't really have anything else to do, and I was focused on this thing, you know, you get into a rhythm of just try, you know, making it, taking it somewhere, you know. And so, yeah, I remember really clearly coming up with that bass line, and it's just the first the verse bass line, basically, in that green room, and maybe the melody that accompanies it. I think they probably would have come together fairly closely. And then we played the show. It was a cool show. I remember it being a big crowd and, you know, it being quite fun playing Oberlin because, you know, people we admire have gone there, like Corey Archangel, the artist, you know, so it was quite interesting. And the other thing that's interesting about Oberlin is that it's really in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we had to drive for a long time or be driven for a long time from a little town called Elyria, just to get there. And that's, you know, it's sort of, I guess, Cleveland is the nearest proper city, but it's a long way from there, really, especially for a European. So after the show, we got driven back in a cab to where we were staying, which was not in Oberlin. It was in Elyria, Ohio, as I said. So we were staying at the Red Roof Inn and Suites in Elyria. Totally American experience. You know, this is quite novel for Brits, even though we'd already done two tours of the US at that point. We hadn't we hadn't experienced much of the Rust Belt or the Midwest, so it was quite specific. And again, I have very specific memories of that visit. I remember we went to a Bob Evans in Elyria, yeah. And I remember the waitress, I don't know if she was doing a bit or it feels like a technique that they have, but she very sincerely, I mean, it seems sincere to me, to us, you know, was talking about her life and what she was having to put up with and the sort of, you know, the sort of bills she was having to pay. And it basically just sounded all really sad and really, really tough. And she seemed, you know, perfectly lovely, but that she just had this really tough, brutal sort of small town life and that it was really tough out there. And I don't know how much it was sort of glamorized for us or de-glamorized for us English people, but no, I remember being very struck by that. And of course this was all just post-Trump, so this was all this kind of, you know, this sort of this culture clash was in the air, you know. But then another memory I have of the same visit, probably the same night, we went to this weird mall, which was just like totally out of the middle of nowhere shopping park kind of mall, and it was totally deserted and it was nighttime. It must have been 7-8 p.m. It was dark and we were the only people there, but a lot of stuff was open. And we went to this funny clothes shop. There's a video of us in the clothes shop, and the clothes are actually like quite interesting, like quite weird graphic tees and stuff. But no, I just remember feeling being in this, I mean, it's a huge cliche, but it was maybe the most liminal mall I've ever experienced. And again, that's extremely time and place, like this isolation, this kind of temporal and physical dislocation, you know, just as maybe you can already tell, when we're making a record, we often use what will be the title as an adjective. Like it just becomes an adjective, like, oh, that's so civilization. That's so time and place. We're doing it with the record we're making at the moment as well. And yeah, I mean, that mall was truly extremely time and place. And anyway, point being, after the Oberlin show, I think I would have already had all of those experiences as well by this point. So a certain kind of weird atmosphere going on in our brains. Went back to the hotel room and Jamie would have been going to sleep. So I recorded this demo, which I'm pretty sure it was recorded on the 16th of April, 2017, in me and Jamie's room that night at the Red Roof Inn and Suites in Elyria, Ohio. And I was recording it quietly so that Jamie wouldn't be woken up by me recording it. And it is, it's basically almost, in terms of the musical content, almost exactly what became the verse of Make Believe, which is kind of amazing. And the demo is actually called Ohio. I actually called it that on the iPhone. Yeah. Because, and again, that, I guess that's a little bit interesting, right? It's sort of, suggests the novelty we found in being in Ohio, or maybe, you know, the feeling I had about writing this song in, you know, kind of deep Rust Belt America or something. So that was the first step. And then actually, I mean, the next step moved quite quickly. It was, the very next day, actually, we were flying from Elyria. Well, not from Elyria, from Cleveland. You have to get to Cleveland from Elyria to Seattle, but we had to change in Chicago. So we're getting a flight from Cleveland to Chicago. And I remember being on this plane, you know, it would have been, I don't know, some internal American airline or United, I don't know. Or maybe it was Delta, it doesn't matter. The point is, often when you've come up with a song or you want to write a song, I will sort of run through it in my mind lots and lots and lots. And I think actually this is a thing that can happen when I'm not in front of an instrument or a DAW or DAW, is that I can end up sort of basically being impatient and trying to write the song in my head. And this process definitely was happening with Make Believe, because I remember being on this plane, kind of getting up to use the bathroom on the plane and sort of running it through my head. And I basically imagined the music that became the chorus having written this little Casio SA46 thing already. I don't know if I would have played any of that on the keyboard beforehand. I think not. I think I just had this musical idea in my head. And it was one of those musical ideas, and I wonder if you have experienced this yourself, where sometimes a melody and a lyric emerge as one, right? I think often, you know, often songwriters talk about sort of singing gibberish that might feel good with a melody, or that's how they come up with melodies. And I think often, you know, those melodies, those gibberish lyrics rather, those sounds at least, end up being present in the final song. I don't know. Sometimes you don't really edit them. And my memory of it is that I was on this plane thinking of this... And that all my life I tried to find the time to make believe, being really kind of sort of basically appearing incomplete. Like, how do I say? I remember that chorus kind of appearing ready-made in my head, not fully, but that lyric. So that lyric, I remember sort of having that lyric in my head and thinking, oh, well, those are just arbitrary nonsense lyrics. I'm going to change those. But then thinking, no, they're not really shifting. They're too catchy. I think the song has to be that. And so Make Believe would have been in that sort of initial lyrical brainwave, I suppose.
It's nice when you put your foot down for that very critical part of your brain, which is like, oh, it feels good, but it's not enough. It's nice when you're just like, no, it's right.
Well, you know what's funny about that is I think on the plane, I definitely would have felt like, oh, yeah, that'll change. It would have been a bit later. I was like, you know what? That lyric isn't going anywhere. Like, it has to be that lyric. And, you know, I think it's cool. Like, I think it's interesting that my subconscious was saying that at that point. I mean, this is why I wanted to talk about, you know, run you through this anecdote, because, yeah, I mean, that is so, like, my subconscious was literally just saying or writing this song that went, all my life I've tried to find the time to make believe, you know, as if that the control vector was my imagination that was, you know, apparently sort of so in need by my subconscious at that moment or something. Yeah, so... That was at that, and at that stage, you've got a pretty solid idea. Like, that can go into a, you know, hat, and you're kind of like, well, okay, that could be a competitor. That could it, do I want to flesh that out or not? You know, and it got to the stage where yes, that was something we wanted to flesh out, and the next step would have been kind of two separate processes: finishing the music and finishing the lyrics. So the music, I remember very clearly having Logic open at home in my bedroom, because I still made all my music in my bedroom at that time, and just sort of standing in front of my desk, not sitting down, I remember that clearly, with this Logic file, and it's this MIDI demo, which is just called W, because all of the MIDI demos that I made at that time just had, on purpose, the names were just letters of the alphabet and not in any order, just completely randomly. The idea there was that the titles wouldn't influence the direction of the song. I wanted this. That's, I mean, it's great. It's maybe. I wonder if it's almost a little bit too kind of like paranoid or something. But it was very intentional. You know, I didn't want to call
it. Makes sense. It makes sense, especially because you said it's such a big part of your process to have the title first. So it makes sense that you're trying to slightly be conscious of that.
Like, if I'd have titled it Ohio, maybe I would have called the song Ohio or something. I don't know. But no, it was W, and it was actually really hard to find that file, because, you know, searching W on your hard drives is not, you know, it's not going to find, you know, specific, a concise list of files, you know. So there is this folder of all the time and place MIDI ideas, which has just these weird, alphabet names. And I remember the big breakthrough that I made when I was writing the music on Logic was that quasi middle eight section after the second verse. And I don't know exactly what brainwave it was that pushed me to write it like that, but I've always been really pleased with how that turned out, how the second verse kind of, I mean, I love things in songs that don't repeat, that only happen once, where the basic material of a song is spun out into something more complex, not more complex, but more, more exploratory without actually, you know, without just crowbarring in some completely different idea. You know, I mean, it's hopefully the kind of elegance that someone like Bach would have employed in a composition where the economy of material is actually very strong, but it's about, you know, playing with the material in interesting ways to make it go to interesting places. And so that, you know, and in the song and that section, it gets very distorted, sort of, it's meant to be a little bit of a jump scare moment, a little bit of a kind of reinvigoration of where the song's going. Mm. I mean, I think all of this really comes from the very conscious effort that I've made for a long time, and especially from Time and Place onwards, to try and make the songwriting from a listener's perspective as interesting as possible, to use chords that aren't the everyday chords, to use, you know, to make the chord sequence turn around at points that aren't the normative points, just to try and push the boundaries of the basic framework. And, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that these are the most sort of hardcore innovative songs ever written or anything like that at all. There's so far you could take this, but I think it's really an interesting and worthwhile pursuit to try and push that as far as you can while remaining in the stylistic frameworks that you're operating in. You know, I mean, that's how you make things that are simultaneously compulsive, but fresh at the same time. And so, yeah, I would have very, very consciously been thinking, how can we make this a bit more interesting? What chord change would make this more interesting? Not that one. What if we change this at this beat? Okay, that's cool. Where can it modulate to? Da, da, da. You know, really, like, really sort of quite, sort of, not desperately, but, because actually when it's desperate, it doesn't normally work. But, yeah, very sort of effortfully, you know, trying to make those moments happen. And then from that point on, it was, you know, we'd already had that bit in that song's, you know, a little bit sophisticated. And then I think it felt fairly plain sailing to the end of the song. So where the only other significantly different thing that happens in the song, chord wise, is the chord sequence at the very end of the song is different as well. And, you know, I love the form that a song takes. I really love when you listen to a song, you get a sense of its gestalt and you feel like, oh, well, there's something quite formally elegant about the coda of this song, or about the way that, you know, the second verse of this song has an extra section, or the way the middle eight of the song actually repeats at the end of the song, but only half, you know, in half or something. Like, these kind of little formal devices really, really, really appeal to me. And make believe is definitely, and again, it doesn't have to be that complicated. In fact, the more complicated it is, the less you lose the effect of those devices. I think there's a sweet spot where there's some kind of intrigue going on, but it's in an obvious enough framework that you feel it, basically, right? And so, yeah, for me, make believe is definitely an attempt at that approach. So that was, you know, and then, yeah, I had this MIDI, I call them MIDI demos. I mean, they're MIDI demos insofar as that they're, you know, Logic preset sampler sounds, just, you know, with my step sequencer data that I would make. And they have this sort of ridiculous like rock guitar sound that Logic has. And what's also interesting about that demo is that it suggests a stylistic path which was not taken actually in the end. And that's interesting because it ties into, you know, what you were asking about how, you know, I perceive the production of the song or the final version versus the initial idea. And so that W demo, it's like a general MIDI or not, you know, post general MIDI vision of make believe being like a pop punk song. Right, it opens with this guitar. The arpeggio figure that is at the start of the song is played on an electric guitar. Like, na 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 na. I mean, I was literally thinking of Blink 182 or something. You know, like some sort of reference like that. And you know, the drums, and that wasn't just because the sounds on Logic lean to that stylistically. That was me very consciously going, you know, because at the same time I would have been writing songs like Only Acting. You know, that very consciously. Mm-hmm. you know, comes off stuff like Pinkerton by Weezer, you know. And so I did have this specific pop punk rock idiom in my brain. And yeah, I thought that sort of, when I was writing the song, that made total sense to me, you know, like, yeah, that's what it's going to be, you know. I can't remember at exactly which point it changed, but it did. But before that happened, I also wrote the rest of the lyrics for the song. And so there were a few revisions to the lyrics of Make Believe. I say revisions, I mean, some of them would have been not totally complete. But it was really interesting looking back through those. The one that I really vividly remember doing is the handwritten one, which it has these lyrics like an open door, an astronaut, a bunch of cushions on the floor. Like, it's a completely different...
It's very dream sequence,
yes,
kind of.
Exactly. And that,
like,
I think...
illustrative or whatever, yeah.
Yes, and exactly. And you know what? It's actually coming back to me now as I recount this. The reason that verse is written like that is because this would have been before I had the idea of sort of putting the lucid dreaming, maladaptive daydreaming stuff in the song. At this point, I was just going off the name Make Believe. And to me, that term, obviously you think of imagination, you think of being a kid, da 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 da, and these are all quite time and place relevant ideas in a way. So that lyric describes being a kid, sort of playing with your imagination, like having a bunch of cushions on the floor and jumping across them as if you're jumping across rocks on lava. That is what that verse is about. And I remember I wrote that in a park called High Elms, which is near where I grew up and live in Bromley. And I love going there. It's one of my favourite places in the world, really. And I had this thing during time and place I'd never really done before where I would go to a destination to write lyrics. And I'm not sure if it was a bit of an avoidance thing. I was a bit like, oh, I'm going to put off writing lyrics at home. But, oh, if I go somewhere, then I can do it. I mean... It worked actually very successfully with a song called Flyway, which is also on Time and Place. And that song was written in a different park, and I was just watching the scene in the park and almost just writing the lyrics down, and it really worked. So I was like, oh, this is a strategy. But I remember going to High Elms to write this Make Believe verse, and no, it was really one of those horrible writing sessions where you're like, oh, like trying to get blood out of a stone, you know. And I think it was because I hadn't really settled on the theme. The real theme of the song. I had this imagination idea that sort of worked with the chorus, but I couldn't really, like, I couldn't orient it in such a way that it felt concise to me. I did write some of the rest of the chorus in that session, though, and actually a lot of that, you know, that second half of the chorus did end up largely in the final song. And, you know, again, it's about control. It's if I never get to decide my reality. And I was deciding between decide my reality and define my reality. That's
a big decision. I'm being completely serious. That's a big decision.
No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And those are the types of decision that with a song like this, I would be, you know, poring over for weeks, to be honest. I mean, not exclusively. I'd be doing other stuff as well. But no, it could be like, you know, that a decision like that might not have been settled until the recording session, literally, you know. And because, again, I mean, it does have a different heft. And it's funny with make-believe, because after all that happened, only later would I have gone, ah, yeah. I can't remember if it was reading. So there was this amazing article about a girl who had a maladaptive daydreaming issue problem. And since they've basically handicapped Google, I can't find this article. You know, I can't Google the same terms I would have used to find the article at the time, because Google is just useless now. That's a whole other grievance. But no, it was this amazing article that was about, and I hadn't really heard, I've always been a daydreamer, right? But I hadn't really heard of this phenomenon of people enacting it so aggressively that they can just, that they would just sit at home or lie in their bed. And this girl would imagine being, you know, a pop star, going out on amazing dates with the most, you know, desirable guys, the most beautiful food, dinners, everything, going on holiday. And the way she recounted it, it was as if she, it was actually very similar to the lucid dreaming thing, in that it was as if she was recounting total reality just from her daydreams. And I found that article fascinating. And yeah, I think it would have been around that time. And also because, you know, we've all had, you know, in KKB, I remember we had a conversation about experiences we'd had with sleep paralysis. So that distorted bit when it says, you know, however real it seems, that's about sleep paralysis, which I've never, again, I've never experienced that literally in that form. But, you know, I know people who have, and their accounts of it are really quite terrifying, actually, because, and again, it's this whole spectrum of experiences which fall between reality and well, they're not, are they fantasy if they're perceived? I mean, that's the really interesting question. And so at some point after writing that initial handwritten lyric, I would have probably read that article about the maladaptive daydreamer and, you know, had some chats about with pals about sleep paralysis and whatever, and lucid dreaming being a thing I've, you know, I'd been aware of for ages. And realised, okay, that's the centre, that's the weight that this song needs, that I can write the rest of these lyrics,
yeah,
concisely.
That was
around
your hook,
exactly.
Yeah, that was like the unlocking, yeah,
exactly right. And so the later drafts are more in that. I think they are. I think, well, definitely the final song is. I can't remember if there's an interim lyric draft, which is maybe sort of in between. But no, yeah, eventually. Yes, it was clearly that. And when I ended up writing the lyrics for Make Believe, it would have been just a job of me writing the lyrics on the computer in the same room that I made all the music in. You know, it wasn't, you know, sometimes I think your subconscious can be productive when you give it a certain, put it in a certain situation. But sometimes you just got to sit down and write those lyrics. Like someone has to do it, you know.
Sometimes it's a job. It not really, but it sometimes it does feel like work.
No,
and
totally.
You're a bit eye roll. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. No. I mean, you know, the record we're working at the moment, there are tasks that I'm like, well, you know what? I've just got to sit down and do this. Like, you have to actualize the record. Like, you can't just imagine the greatest record ever in your head, you know. But ironically enough, for the content of this song. But I think it's funny, recounting all this makes me realize that, in a way, the sort of thematic content of Make Believe, I wouldn't say it's piecemeal, but it's definitely a little bit more collagic than some of the other songs. Like, there's the first song on the album is called Outside. It's just basically about the physical experience of being outside. Very, very clear, very obvious, you know, no real dissonance in or ambiguity in its presentation. Make Believe, it is a bit more ambiguous, and it encompasses this sort of range of experiences. And in retrospect, the way that it gestated explains that, actually. You know, I think it's it's interesting. I hadn't thought about that specifically for a while, but yeah. And then lyrics would have been written, and the next step would have been, I'm sorry, I'm going into this in such detail.
No, it's really interesting.
I think about this stuff quite a lot anyway. But
be careful or you're going to become, or I'm going to force you to be my co-host, Gus. You got to be, don't say that.
I don't know if you want that, because I might just end up rambling over the incredible other songwriters that you ask. So be careful what you wish for, basically. But
asked the right question.
but yes, so the next step was, so for Time and Place, again, this was a real, really conscious break from anything we'd done with KKB before. Me, Jamie, and James Rowland, who was basically a member of KKB's live band in this era, and he plays all the guitar on the Time and Place era KKB stuff, and he did an amazing job. I mean, he's a musician I'd known for a long time, since pre-KKB. His sensibility, in fact, a lot of my perception of the guitar music sensibility would really have come through my experiences with James. He would have been the first person I knew to talk to me about bands like the Brian Jonestown Massacre or Neutral Milk Hotel, you know, bands like that. And so me, Jamie and James went into, funnily enough, the same rehearsal room that KKB's studio is now in Deptford, South London, and we just played through these demos over and over and over again. And it would have been around that time that I realised, okay, we don't want this song to be a pop-punk song. You know what it was? I really remember thinking that intro arpeggio, not really an arpeggio, I mean, it's just two notes initially, two pitches, would have been really hard to play live. Not that James couldn't have done it. I think he did end up doing it, funnily enough. But I just remember thinking, is that a good idea that we should do that? And I remember thinking, what if it changed to synth? And I think that was the beginning of the process of the arrangement vision for Make Believe, changing from this pop punk thing, because also we had other songs sort of in that vein anyway, to this other thing. And I remember very clearly, again, it might have just been an abstract. An abstract concept in my head, that the song should have been, I remember describing it to the recordist, our recording engineer, Jimmy Robertson, who he's great, he's amazing, that's a whole other thing. I remember describing it to him as being a cross between Steeler's Wheel, Stuck in the Middle with You, Stereolab and Prefab Sprout. And, you know, that sort of like acoustic, that strummed acoustic guitar in the choruses, that would have been a total novelty to me at the time. You know, we hadn't made any music. I don't think I'd made any music in my whole life that had a production decision in it like that. You know, the organ sounds that all came off a Casio Tone, the Casio Tone 701 that I've had for years. And I also wrote the Time and Play song Times a Day on that Casio. I love that keyboard, you know. And these other sort of embellishments, which were more sort of KKB-ish, more Time and Place-y, maybe. Maybe it's the other stuff that was more Time and Place-y, and that was almost more the callback to the kind of like synthy KKB that you already knew. I don't know. But yeah, it was that vision was pretty fully formed. I just remember thinking, you know, this chorus especially could work really well with that Steeler's Wheelie kind of guitar strum, you know. There's something kind of troubadour-ish about it, but like a little bit groovy as well. Very sort of post-60s music. And although I'm pretty sure Stuck in the Middle of You is not a 60s record. Is that right? I should definitely be sure on that. I thought it was a 70s record. Anyway, yeah, so I... At that point on, you've got a target that you're kind of aiming for. And so, you know, you have all these different elements coming together now, like the songs written, the lyrics coming together. We have a production vision that we want to fulfill. The one thing that hadn't been sorted at this point was what happened at the end of the song. As I said, so the chords change a little bit after the last chorus. And we actually had to play this song live in April 2018. So this is after Totep, the Totep EP, which preceded Time and Place, had come out. But before anything else from Time and Place, and we had kind of, so we were self-managing at this in this period, which is a whole other crazy story. I mean, that's a whole other nuts thing that had been going on over this period. I could do a whole podcast just about that. But we were self-managing, and we had decided to put ourselves in the deep end by debuting a brand new live show this venue, DIY Space for London, across 3 nights, playing there for 3 nights, like a mini residency-ish thing, you know, sort of just after Totep came out. And it all happened so fast. I mean, in retrospect, it's kind of amazing how we put all this together so quickly. It's crazy. And yeah, so we learnt Make Believe as a song for that set because we didn't have loads of material to play. So we had to kind of work with what we had. And Make Believe was, you know, there enough, I suppose. And I remember we didn't have anything for that end section. And Sarah, for that live set, for that live show we did, she had a cool mini log, which is a little cool polysynth that she would play. She would play a lot of the sort of hooks of the songs and the, you know, riffs and little embellishments that, you know, the, me on keyboard or James on guitar weren't free to play. And, you know, at that point, I remember saying, Sarah, just play what you want here. We don't really have anything here. So if you just play a solo, like, that's fine. Just, you know, it's it needs something, whatever. And so Sarah plays this melody, this... just plays that as a hook, basically. And she came up with that very naturally. She, you know, she just played the thing that she liked and felt good playing. And, you know, so it was good like that. You know, I think she really does. I think she has this that thing that, you know, I guess most music people have where, you know, they can sort of just like generate a musical idea or a musical thing just sort of comes out of them without thinking too hard about it.
Yeah,
and I think
casually.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in a way, when we're talking about that scale, I often think that the less you think about it, the more likely it is to happen, you know. And so Sarah had ended up writing this actually really strong melody. And again, it was a bit like with the chorus lyrics. I was like, well, that's a placeholder. But as time went on, I was like, you know what? That placeholder is not going anywhere. Like, that's the best melody. That's better than any melody I've thought of for this bit. It's definitely going to have to be that melody. Like, let's do it. So, yeah, the end figure is Sarah's, basically. And it came through these rehearsals for this show. And yeah, then we played it. Then it ended up being the third single, you know, of Time and Place. It came out before the album, but yep, it was the third one that did. And yeah, I mean, like all the other songs on Time and Place, we laid down, most of the songs on Time and Place, except for one, I think, we laid down the band instruments at a studio called Press Play Studios in Bermondsey, which is also opposite where Jamie lived at the time on Ilderton Road. This is all very local South London stuff to us. And we recorded it with Jimmy Robertson, who had... He's an amazing recording engineer. It was recommended by a friend. And he had recorded... He'd, funnily enough, recorded that Late of the Pier album I mentioned earlier. So it was this really crazy... And you know, one of our favourite albums... Black Fantasy Channel by Late of the Pier. He'd recorded it. And when I found that out, I was like, we need him to record the band for this album because it's you know, the band part sounds so good on that album and they do on Time and Place because Jimmy is amazing. And yeah, so we did that. And actually, okay, this is important in terms of the production. So we recorded the band parts and that stemmed from our rehearsals that we'd done, you know, me, James and Jamie practicing these songs. And so we laid down those parts. It was cool. I remember us having to work on Make Believe a little bit because it's a little bit harder than a song like Only Acting. You know, it's faster. It has the weird change after the second verse. Like some of the chord changes are. A big thing with Make Believe was it has a lot of pushes. The chords change on the offbeat a lot of the time.
I noticed that. Okay, right. That makes sense. It's good to hear you say that because I noticed that it was a different,
yeah,
very conscious thing. Okay.
And that's interesting because on the demos, it changes in different places, right? The pushes aren't in all the demo versions because we just hadn't figured out the best places for it yet. And again, it's one of those sort of songwriting things of just refining. Okay, like, okay, those are the pushes. That's where it should fall, right? We'll be right back. So yeah, laid down the parts and, you know, had to spend a bit of time getting them right. And we, you know, we did our thing. And then for Time and Place, I took all these band recordings and I took them back home to my bedroom, to my laptop. And I would just produce over the top of the recordings, basically. You know, I'd produce the songs from those recordings. I'd record Sarah in the bedroom, like she would, you know, she would come over. We just record the vocals on, honestly, I think we recorded a lot of those vocals on maybe like a hand, like a Zoom handheld recorder or something, like something really crazy like that. You know, and so, in fact, yeah, I'm sure it was that because there's a video of us, a video on YouTube of us from that era called KKB Life, which has little clips from the recording process. And you can see Sarah recording some vocals on a Zoom handheld recorder, just on a stack of CDs in my bedroom. That was honestly the vocal setup for Time and Place, which is absolutely crackers, really.
That's mad. That's crazy.
It's, again, very time and place in a way. But I, so, you know, had all that stuff at home. And I also had all my synthesizers at home. And I would overdub a bunch, you know. Basically, I would keep overdubbing until I thought the song sounded finished, basically. When I was overdubbing stuff and the song started sounding less good, that's when I knew I needed to stop. And everything, obviously, it was made in the box, in the computer, but all of the sounds on Time and Place were generated by hardware, and all the synth sounds were, you know, recordings of MIDI-sequenced synthesizers. Hardware synthesized. And that, I mean, I feel a bit funny saying that because it feels like a boast, but it's not a boast. I actually would be very embarrassed about the idea of boasting about that. But honestly, again, Benito Generation and Intro Benito, all made on software, almost exclusively, little bits and pieces here and there, but it was all, you know, relatively polished, at least for me at the time, you know, digital music. And it was refreshing to use hardware, which I've always loved. I've always loved synths and finding weird little Casios with like weird synthesizer functions and getting deep into those. I've always loved all of that. And it was, again, very time and place. It chimed with the dustiness, the kind of the liminal sense of, you know, recording this a funny little Casio synthesizer that has a dusty sound and it sounds weird and broken and it sort of freaks you out in a way that a VST rarely would. You know, playing a resampled sound of my Yamaha VSS 200 is kind of scary. Something uncanny about that. And I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm aware of the process, but it sort of freaks me out in a way that a VST sample job, I don't know. It just has a very different resonance, so to speak. And so I added all the synth overdubs at home and did Sarah's vocal at home. And yeah, I just put it together there. And then, you know, it would have just been a case of, you know, adjusting to taste. And then we took that for mixing mastering with another fella called Anthony Lim. And he did Time and Place and he made it sound really cool. And yeah, that was the process. That is the the long version of the process of writing Make Believe. Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. I also, yeah, that's kind of like a perfect place, like kind of a closing statement is that you never ended the songwriting process really until you sent it away for mixing and mastering.
Yeah. And I mean, I even attend, you know what? Okay. What's extra funny about that? So I attended the mixing mastering session. and I mean, I know control, talk about this song has this control theme, right? And I mean the control freakery, I totally concede, but so another aspect of this song, which I'm really happy with and I haven't mentioned, is the guest vocal by Z Santos. And they are known for singing in the band Crying, but also for their own really cool solo work and generally being, you know, yeah, one of the cooler figures I've come across in the indie music world, I suppose. And I always really liked their vocal tone. And I thought, you know, I thought Z's vocals on the Crying stuff were just this really perfect, just perfect kind of tuneful, not too affected. I don't like vocals that are too affected and sort of too sort of histrionic. That's just not my taste. I think if I think when they let the music speak for itself, I find that really beautiful. And I think Z's delivery and Z's lyrics always did that. So I was, you know, we were very chuffed to get them on this song. And I really just gave them lyrics to sing, and they sent over these little recordings. I'm not sure how they did it, if it was a little home recording deal, and they just went straight in the song. And I remember when I was in the mixing session with Anthony, so I would do most of the effects myself in my production stage, you know, all your choruses, delays, reverbs, all that kind of stuff. But I remember I sort of was in such a rush that I hadn't put any delay on Z's vocal. And I remember saying to Anthony, can you let me fiddle around with like a delay plugin for like 5 minutes, just because I want to put some delay on this vocal that I haven't even put delay on. I mean, it was again, like very, very, very kind of chaotic, in a sort of like handing in your coursework on deadline day way. But in a sense, that really does fit the very collagic, messy time and place aesthetic. So yes, I was tweaking it right until the end. I definitely, and I remember sending in, you know, we would have had a mix and mastered version, and I would have sent Anthony some stuff to add in. I was like, oh, there could be an extra, there's a synth counter melody at the end. So while the, while that's happening, there are these other synth melodies that are going, that would have been, I added that after I heard the initial mix and master and went, that bit's not happening enough. You know, this really crazy control freak kind of method, I guess. But yeah, no, it ended up being what it is. And, well, you know, I'm cool with it. Like, I think it's a song that is one of KKB's more sort of, I think KKB fans responded well to this song, you know, and obviously yeah, that's
it's
really a, nice.
It's amazing. It's amazing too, how decisive you have to be, because there's so many possibilities, and
yeah,
because you're open to possibility, and also that's a source of inspiration for you.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's really interesting that then you have to develop the counter tools of being, you know, decisive at a certain point and knowing when, you know, just like you were saying, this idea of make believe, like you thought that was a placeholder, or Sarah's synth part, you were like, oh, we'll figure that out later. And then you eventually have to be like, no, this is it. Like, to me, that's one of the really hard things about songwriting, is being decisive. So,
yes. And the reason it's so hard is because there's no right or wrong answer. You know, again, I think something that I've been thinking about a lot over the last year or so is how, you know, I went to a grammar school, you know, I was sort of the nerdy kid at school. I was always encouraged to kind of, you know, do well in the maths tests. And I really placed a lot of value on that as a kid. You know, I was really all about that. If I got less than 90% in a test, it wasn't my parents didn't care. It was me. I was really upset. It was just me putting the pressure on myself. And I think that attitude lingers a bit, right? But the fact is, you know, okay, well, you might quantify it in terms of streaming count or, you know, critic score or something. You know, there is no right or wrong. There's no 10 out of 10 when you're making resonant cultural objects. Like that is just a totally abstract concept in that field, you know. It's scary because, you know, you want to get it right, but you can only decide for yourself whether, well, obviously you can have A&R people and other musicians, and actually all that stuff is really great and I thoroughly recommend it. But, you know, only people, you know, the sort of people that approve it, so to speak, can really decide whether it's their right or wrong answer, you know. But no, I definitely... I've definitely experienced overthinking records. You know, in a way, it was good that we had set a sort of really hardcore self-enforced deadline with Time and Place. It sort of forced us to, you know, make it and finish it and decide. Yeah, you have to assert. You know, this is it. This is the thing. You know, and I think having that sort of. I mean, also another side note. This is not a boast. I'm not proud of this. I was working really insane hours to make Time and Place. I mean, I remember when I was producing, in the production stage especially, that stage of overdubbing all the synths at home and finishing the songs up and sending them off to mixer and mastering. You know, I remember sort of going to bed at like 6:30 in the morning and waking up at 10:30 and just going as hard as I could all day. And then just, I would do, God. I did, it was absolutely brutal. And you know, I think it's really bad for you. Like, I think it's really, really unhealthy. Like, yeah, as someone who's done that, like, just do not do that. It is, yeah, it I felt like it might have, like, I don't think it's, like, permanently done anything. I don't know. But it's definitely, like, you can feel your body, like, deteriorating. It's absolutely brutal. So I don't know. I don't want to glamorize that. But the reality of it was that it, you know, there was a fire under our butts, kind of like, look, we've got a tour booked. We have to finish this album. It's ridiculous, you know. And yeah, anyway, the rest is history or not.
It did get finished. The rest is time and place.
Now that's one thing I can say for sure. Yeah, it was.
Well, thank you so much, Gus. You'll have to do a part two when your new record is ready, if you feel like it, because I think
I would love to do that. Oh, I mean, yeah. I could probably do a part two about the new record now with it not even being finished yet. A lot of what we've talked about, or really what I should say, what I've rambled about, is, you know, it's the reflection of the thought process that I have all the time when I'm making music. And because I'm making music all the time, it's pretty much all the time, you know. But no, I'm still totally fascinated by the process of it. I don't think anyone will solve it because it's inherently unsolvable. And, you know, I think that it's one of the richest experiences in my life that I'm aware of. You know, it's not easy, but it's endlessly fascinating, you know. And yeah.
It's magic.
Yeah. It is actually quite literally magic, in my opinion. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Gus. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Alaska.